Authors, writers, dreamers, all. Each day is an invitation to accept the call. I'm Brooke Warner from She Writes.
And I'm Grant Faulkner from NaNoWriMo. You're listening to Right Minded, weekly inspiration for writers. Hey everyone, if you've been listening for the past 2 weeks, then you know that Brooke isn't Jordan, which means I'm here by myself. Today's episode is our third and final week of interview mashups, and I hope you're having a wonderful summer. I am. I'm doing what I love, traveling to other places in my novel, although I wouldn't mind hopping on a plane, to Jordan, to join Brooke, perhaps. Brooke and I chose Kwame Alexander and Abigail Thomas for today's episode because they're both writers who are thinking outside the box and thriving outside the box, following their own rules and their own instincts. And per usual, if you love what you hear, scroll down in your right-minded feed and just listen to the full original episode. So I'm sitting here wondering what Brooke is doing today. I wonder how hot it is today in Jordan. I'm wondering if she'll tell us all about it when she's back next week. And we hope you'll tune in because we're celebrating 1 year of Right Minded and we have some changes in store to tell you about. So see you next week, everybody. Let's get started with Kwame Alexander. I'm excited to talk with you because I love authors who take risks and do things that might be considered counterintuitive or even uncommercial. And I mention this because when I think of writing stories for kids, I think that the very last approach I might take is writing the story in verse. Yet your books have reached so many readers because they're in verse, not in spite of it. And so I wanted to hear your thoughts on why do you think so many young readers have responded to your genre-bending style?
Well, I think when you think about verse and rhyme and rhythm and poetry, and you think about kids, of course they go together. I mean, what kid didn't learn Dr. Seuss? What kid wasn't familiar with Green Eggs and Ham? You know, what kid didn't get lullabies sang to them by their parents? Or, you know, what kid didn't have some connection to Shel Silverstein or really funny rhyming verse? Like, that's how we learn. We learn how to speak, write, listen, and, you know, by rhythm and rhyme. And so it makes perfect sense to me. Like, but apparently to everybody in the industry, nobody got it. And I do. I just think that is the way that kids communicate, learn, and love literature. It's through the rhythm. It's through the figurative language. It's through the really sparse text. And ultimately, it's through, you know, having some sort of emotional connection, all the things that poetry is. So when I said about writing novels in verse, I knew this was going to be the thing. It just made perfect sense to me. And I guess I've spent the last 4 years trying to convince everybody else that it is the case.
I love the confidence you had in your vision of telling the story. I think that's valuable for every writer, no matter if they're writing in verse or not. And I know, I remember talking with you once and using the term reluctant reader. And you said that you didn't believe in the term. It's a phrase that's often used in educational circles in particular. And so I'd love if you could tell me your take on the kids that many label as reluctant readers.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the word. I think it's a personal thing for me because I was called reluctant and I was the most well-read kid in my high school. Like my parents, they worked in the education field. They attended teacher's college. My father was a publisher. My parents were writers. I had this like intimate connection with books so much so that I had read 100 books in first grade during the summer. You know, by seventh grade, I had read books like Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire, which most graduate students were reading. I had read most of the Heinemann African Writer series. I had read so many books, and most of those books I was forced to read by my dad because, you know, he thought that was the thing, you know, to do to get me to read these books that he was interested in, but I wasn't. So I didn't have a choice what I had to read. So the deal isn't I wasn't reluctant to read. I was reluctant to read the books he was giving me. And so I find that that shouldn't be sort of the go-to place for us as educators, as parents, as teachers, that kids who aren't reading are reluctant. How about they're just not interested in what we're giving them? How about we give them a book that they're going to, you know, get excited about? How about we find the book that's going to connect with them? And for me, you know, that was sports. It was Muhammad Ali. I was reading a book about Ali last night, and that was, you know, that's the thing that got me as a 12-year-old, this book called The Greatest. So I think we got to find books that kids are interested in because they're not necessarily reluctant. They're just not interested.
Yeah, it's such a good point. I have a 7-year-old boy, and so I know that parents everywhere relate and respond to exactly what you're saying. And Kwame, you're such an amazing ambassador for helping everyone tell their story through your work with the organization you founded, Book in a Day, and now as an ambassador for the Great American Read. Do you think this known problem of lack of diversity in children's literature is improving at all?
Is the lack of diversity in...
in children's literature, yeah. Is it getting better?
Sure, I hear the question. I guess I was going to ask you, is it improving in our lives?
Right.
You know, I mean, think about it. Like, who are you hanging out with? Who are you having dinner with? Who are your kids going to school with? Like, the diversity in kids lit is representative of the diversity in America, in the sense of, yeah, there's a lot of different kinds of people from different backgrounds, just like there's a lot of potential books from different, about different people from different backgrounds. But are we really sort of living the kind of life, you know, that that is representative of what we're saying we want in the books? And so it's one thing to talk about we need to have more books, but how about the books we have? We need to have more books that are diverse on our shelves. Like, what kind of books are on your bookshelf? So I just get real, it's a real interesting topic, and it's not like one answer. And of course there should be more diversity in books, because there's more, you know, there's more stories to tell. There's more people in our lives. But I think more importantly, I just want us to have more diverse lives.
Right. I mean, I hear you. It sounds like you're saying it's not enough, right? I mean, we can have diversity in children's literature. We can talk about it, but there's some kind of lack of follow through or conversation about how is it impacting people.
I think you answered the question, Brooke. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to steal that.
Please do.
I'm taking it.
Well, hey, Kwame, you know, your life as a writer has been a long and winding one, as I think most writers' lives are. And I recently read or heard the story about the crossover, and I read that 22 publishers rejected it, and most said there was no market for a poetry-infused, sports-themed children's book because boys wouldn't read poetry and girls wouldn't read about sports.
Right.
So I'm very intrigued by writers who receive and overcome the volume of rejections like that. Like, how did you have the patience to keep going and to dig in and keep going after so many rejections? Like, I oftentimes say that for me, at least, rejection is a revision tool. It helps me go deeper into the work. Was that the case with you?
Yeah, it was that, but it also is, it pissed me off. I mean, it was frustrating, you know, it was sad. It was tragic to get just that much rejection, but I'm not like the only writer. Like, most of us go through this. I think it's a part of the journey. I think what allowed me to keep going forward was because ultimately I believed in the project. You know, I was passionate about it. I put in the work. I knew what I was talking about. And generally I loved the story. And I think when you have that kind of relationship to your art, it doesn't matter if someone is saying, you know, your art can't be exhibited in this gallery, then you'll go sell it on the street. It doesn't matter if someone is saying, you know, your book is not that good for whatever reason, and so we aren't going to publish it, you'll go publish it yourself. So ultimately, that's what it came down to. I believed in it enough where I just decided, you know, if these people don't think it's that good, yeah, it makes me frustrated, and maybe I'm doubting myself, but ultimately, I feel like it's good, so I'm just going to publish it myself. And I think once I had that, you know, that intention, and I made that decision, I felt like ultimately a little bit more in control. And that's when the offer started coming in. It was really interesting. Once I decided to publish it myself, then I got some interest in the book. And that was, you know, a 5-year journey.
I hope that works for every writer, that once they decide to self-publish their book, the door opens to more.
Right.
Did you ever have a moment where you just woke up and said, that's it, I should give up?
Probably about 36 of them. Yeah, it happened. You know, I started writing. I wrote my first book in 94. And there were moments during that first book, you know, 5-10 times where I was like, I can't do this. It's too much. I just can't. I can't publish this book. I don't have the money. I don't have the, I can't deal with all the work. It's just too much work, the stress. So, you know, and I remember my dad gave me seven, like I was at my wit's end. Like I had finally gotten up enough nerve and confidence to publish the book in 94 and of course didn't have the money. And my dad had given me $1,700 to go and print the books. So that particular relationship to the work, doubting that this is really something I want to do or can do, it happened a lot. I have my 28th book coming out October the 2nd. And this is, you know, this is not hyperbole. This is completely accurate. Yesterday I had this thought, maybe this book isn't supposed to happen. Maybe, you know, so this is yesterday. And so, and for a variety of reasons, I just came to this conclusion, maybe this book is just not going to happen. And maybe I just don't want it to happen. So I think as writers, you know, for myself, yeah, I still deal with that. But I think that's cool. It's all a part of the journey, the writerly journey. Ultimately, what the thing is, how much do you love what you're doing? And will you work through all that stuff? Because I think that stuff is, it just makes you stronger. It makes you have more, you know, clearer vision about the path we're on. But I think that stuff is a part of it. You just got to deal with it and accept it and learn from it and figure it out and sort of figure out how to make the, you know, the magic happen out of whatever type of challenges or doubts you're having.
Next up is Abigail Thomas.
So Abby, hi, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me. Thank you.
Last time I spoke with you, you were living with kids and grandkids and animals and trying to write your next book. And so before we even dive in, I want to ask, how is your writing life going these days? And are you finding the time to write your next book? And is your next book about the pleasures and pitfalls of being in your late 70s as it was last time we spoke?
Yeah, it is. I'm having a really hard time making it into a book. I mean, I have all these little snatches of things and it isn't adding up to much yet. So what I'm doing is taking some of the things I want very badly to write about and are difficult to write about and trying to make longer essays out of those.
Well, that's great to hear. And I'm glad because I want to see more of your writing. And I wanted to just note this thing about the fact that you started writing in your late 40s and that now you are in your late 70s. I just think that age is something that no one really pays attention to until you start being sort of outside of the bounds, right? Like if you're really young or particularly old. And so how does age these days inform what you write about?
It's what I write about. It's absolutely fascinating to me what you've left in the road behind you, what no longer makes you self-conscious, the joys of it, how interesting it is to talk to another elderly person about what hurts and what they take for it. There's so many interesting things, and all of the self-consciousness is gone. You can just say whatever you want. I think age is very interesting. My sister likes to say, you're much more concerned about being 77 than I am being 72, as though it's a bad thing. But I think when you're a writer, whatever is at hand is what you're going to write about. And it is funny to be, because when I hear the word elderly, I immediately picture somebody frail and collarbones prominent and with a shock, I'm elderly. It's such a funny feeling. There was the weather was on the other day and it was wind chill factors for today and tomorrow. Most at risk, he said, children and the elderly. And it was a moment before I realized, holy shit, I'm the elderly. And it's so funny to be both elderly and me, you know, because I'm sort of the same person I've always been, only maybe a bit more so.
I'm just curious. I've been listening to you and I'm thinking about how I know you're fascinated by memory and this idea, and which comes with, I get more and more fascinated by memory the older I get, actually.
Oh, it is interesting. Yeah.
And this idea of who memory belongs to. And I'm just curious about, since you've written three memoirs, Can you tell us, like, what's drawn you to memoir and your take on memory, given that you teach about it and have probably thought it about it a lot more than the average person?
Well, what's interesting about memory are the things that you do remember, and then the things that you don't remember, and then the things that you remember absolutely dead wrong. My first memoir, I didn't know I was writing anything. It was after my second husband died. We'd been divorced forever and become very, very close friends. And I'd known him since I was 27, and I guess I was in my 40s. And something inside of me, which I didn't even recognize, was saying, you have a past now. This is a moment demarking what used to be from what is going to be. And I just, these little things just came out of me. I didn't really know what they were, but they kept coming. And I, you know, you never mess with something that's got working. And it was a long time before I realized, like, oh my God, I think I'm writing something. And then it was very interesting because there were things I needed to do in the first person and things I needed to do in the third because I needed the distance and sometimes the second, and everybody turned it down. You know, my old editor at Algonquin wanted me to write a novel about this, and I haven't lived my life like a novel. My memory, I have a very good memory for what I remember, but it tends to be moments and not the interstitial material. You know, I remember things very well, but they don't have any. Yeah.
What? Sorry. Yeah. No, I was just going to jump in because it's a perfect segue into what I wanted to ask you about. I remember you having said last time we spoke that that your life has been made up of a million different moments, or that people's lives are made up of a million moments, right? And that they don't neatly arrange themselves into chapters. And sometimes it doesn't make sense. And your memoirs are different, right? I mean, it's one of the reasons I love them so much. They're nonlinear. You don't worry about form so much. You write in spare prose at times, and you make the reader pay attention. And I've thought about whether your memoir writing in particular might be qualified as experimental. And I wonder if anyone has ever said that to you, or if you've ever felt that way, and maybe if you could share a bit about what your process is like.
Well, the process was different for each memoir. The first one was really, it wasn't so much a process as it was paying attention to what was occurring to me and writing it down. I am very bored by chronology. I'm not interested in every bite of every sandwich chewed and swallowed at lunch. I'm just interested in the stuff that has emotional impact for me. And there is jumping around, you know, and I find that so interesting to be somewhere and write that that's happening right now. And then suddenly have a memory of 40 years ago. And that has to fit somewhere too. When I first wrote that, I thought it was going to end with Quinn's death. And then at a certain point I realized, but I'm not dead. I'm not dead. There's more here. And I had an experience with my oldest daughter's first daughter's birth. And I wanted that to be the end. I wanted that to be the place I had to get to and figure out how I'm going to earn this ending. I hope I'm not really making sense, but, and that took me longer. That last chapter took me longer than writing the whole book.
I actually think that makes a lot of sense. I love the idea of earning an ending personally. And it's something more writers should aspire to do. One of the things that strikes me, and we're talking about rule breaking today, and part of the reason is that when you and I spoke, when you taught a class for She Writes University, you were talking about all the things that you aren't bothered by, you know, chronology, theme, narrative arc, denouement, and
narrative arc. I hate that. I really hate it.
Well, and I saw you that day as a real rule breaker, you know, and I thought it would be a great theme for the show. And now you're talking about the ways in which you inadvertently break rules, you know, when you absorb someone's memory, for instance. And so I guess I'm wondering if you even consider yourself a rule breaker in the first place, but if you're not holding all those things in mind that are touted to be important, you know, by whomever, teachers and other folks, editors sometimes, then how do you decide what to write next?
I decide what to write next by what makes me hot, what's exciting to me. I'm not thinking, see, I didn't go to college, so I have no idea. I've read a lot and then I started to write. I have no idea how to, that's why those words irritate me so much. I think almost the less you know, the better off you are, because you're not holding yourself up to things like narrative arc and denouement and all those words that mean absolutely nothing when you're writing about what's interesting to you. You know, there are things that, you know, you'll see a certain color blue and suddenly you'll remember the diner when you were in college for that brief moment in the blue light of the Blue Comet diner. And then you got a whole story there. One thing leads to another. I just write what I want to write. And I'm not trying to do anything in particular except have a really good time and also sometimes an extremely painful time and not make anything up. You know, it's just, I don't have to measure myself against anything because I don't know what it is.
I love that sensibility of writing, and just writing what you want to and taking delight in that. And I think there's something in the way you talk about writing that's very permission giving. So I really appreciate that. I wonder if there's any parting words of wisdom you might give to struggling memoirists out there. And I'll put novelists in that camp as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Any words of hope or encouragement, you know, because we all have to wrestle to get our story on the page.
Well, you know what? If you will allow yourself to write badly and not throw it away, just keep going. Because the way we learn is to do it wrong and then do it a little less wrong and try, never throw out your first draft, because that's where the fire is. Even if the words are going to change, that's where the fire is. And you have to go back to that and catch on again. You have to allow yourself to write badly before you can write well.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Right Minded. I hope the summertime is giving you more time so that you can go back and either re-listen to past Right Minded episodes or catch up by listening to more and getting ready to write this year and during NaNoWriMo specifically, which is coming up soon. So download Right Minded on your Apple Podcasts or whatever you use to get your podcasts. And please help us out by rating us or giving us a review. It really helps people find us. And we will see you next week. Thank you.